is here
Blog
in the South.
Talk Radio.
Our mills down here.
We are the ones to make a brighter day, so let's start giving.
really deals in depth with the Hebrew entries in the Bible itself, a Jewish survival book, a book of wisdom. I'm not doubting that. But a book that the creators deserted because they dare not have the temperament to obey what's in the book. We might yet be the last humanitarians in the world because we were the first humanitarians in the world. We have a crisis around integration. We should have asked for justice. Let integration take care of itself. And we asked for justice and been selective. We would not have integrated ourselves out of existence in so many different places. Many of the black colleges are being taken over in the name of integration, especially the black state schools. The black state schools are being overrun with inept white teachers who can't teach any other place. They go into black schools and do no teaching and get paid for it. We misunderstood what it meant to be with them. We quite forget that some of us are far more competent than some of them, especially in some areas where we've been the masters in the field of teaching and in the field of sciences, in the field of basic mechanics. I think this is a subject that needs to be dealt with because there's a reoccurring crisis. There's a crisis of ideology in our life. We're always choosing other people's ideologies and neglecting our own. This is why Ghana is not the great example nation that it could have been. Not the great beating heart of Africa that it could have been. I'm a great admirer of Nkrumah, but he chose too many outside ideas and outside advisors, and he neglected the advice of his great school teacher, schoolmaster, Joseph E. Dankwa, who kept telling him, you can have a modern state, but you need a traditional African state. You need traditional African values. He kept saying that as for socialism, it's only scientific socialism. Nothing is scientific and fails to work for you, no matter what people call it. Now, one thing our intellects have not learned, that nothing the European mind ever devised was meant to do anything but to facilitate European control over the world. The European wastes no time in humanity or sympathy. He wants to control, and he will control by any means necessary, or he will destroy. He shares nothing with nobody. He never enters into partnerships with other people. And if you think that he's going to enter into a partnership with you, no matter what he calls himself, capitalist, Marxist, or socialist, or anything, he came to control. Under any guise, he must control. But once you understand that, you have to understand, no matter what religion I belong to, no matter what denomination I belong to, no matter what political ideology I follow, my people must always be in charge of themselves. They must be the masters of themselves. And any ideology, any religion, anything that fails to serve that purpose is a waste of our time. All our energy needs to be converted into that. And this is the confusion of what we call our intellect. The role of the teacher, the intellect, the preacher, the role of any kind of leader is to make sure his people know the time of day, the political time of day, the emotional time of day, and the historical and cultural time of day. make sure his people are trained in how to face reality. And if you face reality right now, you will realize that you are living in a society that is dying. The society is not only dying, his society intends for you to die with it. They'll take you down with it that you have within your Henry Clark. First, I want to kind of give an account of myself for not being here next week to let you know that I won't be loafing because I don't even know how to loaf. In fact, I need a lesson in knowing how to rest, let alone loaf. I will be in Durham, North Carolina, delivering a lecture on a panel. This is the 20th anniversary of the publication of Hal Cruz's book, The Crisis of the Negro Intellectual. And I will deliver a paper on the crisis that Hal Cruz neglected. Because Hal Cruz wrote a very interesting book, a very personal book, but he did not deal with the real crisis of the black intellectual. The real crisis of the black intellectual started a long time ago, and it's still there. The crisis of not studying the intentions of other people toward us. The crisis of welcoming future conquerors without knowing they are conquerors. The crisis of making bad alliances and no alliances at all. The crisis of letting other people come into his house and take down the good things about him, his religion, his culture, sometimes his wife, and get away with it. We've been all too kind to people. Hal Cruz writes about the 20th century. I start at the 18th century, B.C., and work straight up. We made a whole lot of mistakes in choosing friends and in choosing religions that were ours in the first place. People take the basis of religions from us, go away and dress them up and come back a few hundred years later and sell them to us as something new. We don't know it was ours in the first place. You should really read St. Augustine and his comments after the conference at Nicaea, when the Europeans took over Christianity and began to whiten it up. He said the whole thing made him laugh. These people are trying to give us a religion we had 3,000 years ago. If we had not only one Christ, we had many Christs, many deities. And I want to deal with the inability of a lot of African scholars to really deal in depth with the Hebrew entry in the Bible itself, a Jewish survival book, a book of wisdom. I'm not doubting that. The book of the creators is that it because they dare not have the temperament to obey what's in the book. We might yet be the last humanitarians in the world because we were the first humanitarians in the world. We have a crisis around integration. We should have asked for justice. Let integration take care of itself. If we asked for justice and been selective, we would not have integrated ourselves out of existence and so many different places. Many of the black colleges are being taken over in the name of integration, especially the black state schools. The black state schools are being overrun with inept white teachers who can't teach any other place. They go into black schools and do no teaching and get paid for it. Misunderstood what it meant to be with them. We quite forget that some of us are far more competent than some of them, especially in some areas where we've been the masters in the field of teaching and in the fields of sciences, in the field of basic mechanics. I think this is a subject that needs to be dealt with because there's a reoccurring crisis. There's a crisis of ideology in our life. We're always choosing other people's ideologies and neglecting our own. This is why Ghana is not the great example nation that it could have been, not the great beating heart of Africa that it could have been. I'm a great admirer of Nkrumah, but he chose too many outside ideas and outside advisors, and he neglected the advice of his great school teacher, schoolmaster, Joseph E. Dankwa, who kept telling him, you can have a modern state, but you need a traditional African state. You need traditional African values. He kept saying that as for socialism, it's only scientific socialism. Nothing is scientific that fails to work for you, no matter what who people call it, what people call it. Now, one thing our intellects have not learned, that nothing the European mind ever devised was meant to do anything but to facilitate European control over the world. The European wastes no time in humanity or sympathy. He wants to control, and he will control by any means necessary, or he will destroy. He shares nothing with nobody. He never enters into partnerships with other people. And if you think that he's going to enter into a partnership with you, no matter what he calls himself, capitalist, Marxist, or socialist, or anything, he came to control. Under any guise, he must control. And once you understand that, you have to understand, no matter what religion I belong to, no matter what denomination I belong to, no matter what political ideology I follow, my people must always be in charge of themselves. They must be the masters of themselves. And any ideology, any religion, anything that fails to serve that purpose is a waste of our time. All our energy needs to be converted into that. And this is the confusion of what we call our intellect. The role of the teacher, the intellect, the preacher, the role of any kind of leader is to make sure his people know the time of day, the political time of day, the emotional time of day, and the historical and cultural time of day. Make sure his people are trained in how to face reality. And if you face reality right now, you will realize you're living in a society that is dying. The society is not only dying, his society intends for you to die with it. They'll take you down with it. That you have within your own mind and within your own body the ability to make a whole new world. But you have to stop answering to stupid names like Negro and minority. You ain't no minority. There's only two people on the face of this earth that might have 1 billion people, the Chinese and us. when you count all of us, including those millions in the Pacific, millions throughout South America, the Caribbean Islands, the United States, and Africa, we might have 1 billion people. Somebody said minority. Answer to minorities every time somebody's going to give away some money. Anytime they're going to give minorities something, you become a minority to get the money. After that, go ahead and be the majority that you are, because that's what you are. All right. Now, I didn't mean to digress that long, but inasmuch as those other people don't own me, I figure you do. And I have to... So I have to kind of let you know what's happening to me when I'm after me. I'm not copping out. Because when I had a stroke a few years ago, 82, I turned to African people, and I got from my sisters and brothers the strength to pull myself together, get out of that bed, and get back on the road again, and to fulfill my mission as a teacher. I never want to be called leader, because I have a hard time leading my two teenagers when they were teenagers. Only 122 right now. I should have never led my wife, but that's how. I confess my failure as a leader. But as a teacher, as a community activist, I think I've inspired a few students to do some good. Because from my classroom, has come 3 ambassadors, almost 20 doctors, 3 doctors at Harlem Hospital. Right now, former students of mine, the night chief of pediatrics hospital in Syracuse, one of my girl students, came up to me in Hunter College and said, "That's the clock I was in your class in the 70s. I said, "Yes, ma'am, what are you doing now?" I thought she was some little mouth-to-house wife. And she said that I'm a chief of pediatrics at hospital in Syracuse. Another student of mine is chief of abdominal surgery at Denver General Hospital. So I sent out there a whole lot of people with their minds pretty straight, rendered some service. So I don't mind being the property of a people, because I think service, especially to your own people, is the highest calling. And to be a teacher. I don't mind you asking me, "Well, if you're not going to be here, well, what are you going to be?" That's your responsibility. Ain't hanging out. Not your age, are you? Give an account of yourself. Where are you going to be? That's family. But the other folks ask me, I get insulted. You ask me, I feel you just interested enough and care enough for to know where I am. All right, let's get into the lecture on the Civil War and its aftermath. Let's look at the period that we're talking about. We're talking about the middle of the 19th century, the 1850s. This is the period that we're talking about. This nation has failed to get a rebirth during the constitutional conferences. Now been offered a chance to straighten itself up and be born again. Slavery and immigration is spreading to the western part of the United States. And some of the poor whites didn't benefit from slavery, saying, we don't want that out here. And not because they love blacks, because they didn't. But they didn't see any benefit for them in having slaves. So they said that as we move to the West and make new nations in the West, we'd rather do it without slavery. And besides, we can do our own labor. They were poor people. They couldn't afford slaves anyway. And so when they opened up Kansas, the poor whites of Kansas began to fight against slavery because they did not want to create still another slave state. And they call it Bloody Kansas. A lot of blacks went into Kansas because they thought that they wouldn't be slaves. But some of the slaveholders, those with the power to enforce their will, had gone into Kansas and had set up shop there trying to create a new slave state in Kansas. These are blacks who went into Kansas, called Exodusters. They did not exit from the United States. They exit from their home within the United States. Now, among us, we have not settled the problem of whether we would or would not stay in the United States. This was the period of Martin Delaney, the period of Robert Campbell, the period of blacks sending delegations out to Africa to look for a place for settlement. It was a period of another shift in population. After the American Revolution, it was discovered that over 5,000 blacks had fought against the United States with the British. And they became unpopular when the British lost the war. So the British had to get them out of here. The British had sent them to an icebox called Nova Scotia. And part of that community is still there. But some of the blacks rebelling against this cold climate asked to be sent elsewhere, so they went to Sierra Leone in West Africa. Liberia is just being opened. And so many blacks from the Caribbean, some from the United States, are now going to Liberia. Liberia was officially opened 1847. What we're trying to look at are the events in the African world on the eve of this war. In South America, the two great states brought into being by slaves, especially in Brazil, had now been more or less broken up or fragmented by the Portuguese, Palmeiras and Bahia. At Palmeiras, they had fought, and not only so long, and it started before the American Revolution, blacks discovered a republic. And no blacks preached about anything called democracy. But when the whites came into Palmeiras, when they agreed to let them in, they treated them with democracy. They didn't say, here, look, my mom's treating the white man like with democracy. They just went and treated him with democracy. If we don't preach about something, if you believe something, you don't have to announce it. You just do it. And they just did it. And ultimately, one of those whites would betray them, and the rest of Palmeiras was destroyed. By ear, the other state had been beaten to its knees and surrendered. That is still a predominantly black area of Brazil. In the West Indies, especially Jamaica, the physical state island in the West Indies, the physical political island in the West Indies, two islands, Jamaica and Haiti. These are the islands that literally determine the direction of the totality of the Caribbean. Jamaica was not at a standstill, but the rebels in Jamaica had fought for many years. Haiti was already free, having been free in the began in the 1700s, in that 20-year period, became free. But I'm saying that Africans in the whole of the world were inspired by the Haitian Revolution. The Haitian Revolution over now, the mulattoes who were to ruin Haiti with a French constitution in power now, but blacks still remember there was a time when blacks drove out whites and established a republic. And except for the offspring of the whites, that republic might have endured, but no one impressed them with an African mold constitution, but with a French constitution. Now, what you need to read here, if you read French and part of it has been translated, the Rochambeau papers. Rochambeau came into Haiti, so-called tame the black. And Rochambeau had played up to them, but he hated both the mulattoes and the blacks. And in a fight against him that he won after the mulatto general favored the French, hoping the French would give them favors over the blacks, Rochambeau played a trick on the mulatto general. He had a ball, and he invited the wives of all these generals. And at the end of the ball, he escorted them into a room to stand by a box. I got a present for you. And they opened the box, and the heads of their husbands was in each box, which proved that no one gained with the internal struggle by thinking you're going to lighten your load by betraying the others. Now, finally, a black general drove out Rochambeau. Haiti fell again into the hands of the offspring of the French. While the Haitians spoke a language that is Creole, part French, part of everything, there was a group of human beings called Creoles who were Haitians and black. Now, Haiti, by the middle of the century, is no more as a vibrant inspiration to the African world because their constitutions are so mangled, and those who have been educated in France spent so much time trying to be French, they couldn't be African. Now, 1850 in Jamaica, the Jamaican Colors has an excellent book on it. Mavis Campbell, who's also just given us a recent book on the Maroons. She's really one of Jamaica's finest women writers, one of the finest writers, period. Great researcher. Not the easiest person to get along with because she's really a black English woman. But her values are that of an English woman. But she is a master researcher. She will trace a fact down like a hound dog until she find out what the beginning and the end of it. And when she come up with it, ain't nothing left to be found that she hasn't got. But she was working 5 years on this one book on the Maroons. She even called the Maroons my Maroons. She owns them. But now, 1850 in Jamaica. We're dealing with the period that led to the Civil War all over the world. In Jamaica, that group tried to make a deal with the English that if you favor us, give us the basic privileges, you won't have to worry about the blacks. Because we will protect you from the blacks. The British didn't give them the deal. The British had some second thoughts about it. Because many of them now joined the blacks and began agitation with the blacks. By 1865, Jamaicans understood that their emancipation was a phony. That you be emancipated, now you're a free man. You got to take care of yourself, your clothing, your family, and everybody else. All the things now you got to do for yourself. You got no job, no other island. You got no other island to go. So you have to go back to the same farm where you were a slave. The planters got the best of the deal. Now this caused more anger. And this anger would reach fruition around 1865 in the Morette Bay confrontation. But my point is, on the eve of the Civil War, and as an aftermath of the Civil War, African people were consistently in revolt. Now, in Africa itself, the Zulu Wars had started, having started early in the 1800s, Chaka had lived and died, having died in 1828. Chaka's successor, Dingaan, is now in power. Dingaan, people think of Chaka, the great Zulu, as opposition to the white. That means you misread history. Chaka never fought in the white. Chaka fought blacks to consolidate blacks, to save the country for the blacks. Had he won, there'd been no South African problem because there wouldn't be nobody in South Africa but blacks. But he didn't win. And his successor and assassin, half-brother, took over. And he began the opposition to the whites, the Dutch, wanted to move away from the coast to find a separate republic on the other side of the Vaal River called Transvaal. They did establish the republic. It's still in existence. But before that, they had to defeat Dingaan, who had stopped them 3 times. Now the British realized that if any African defeated any white, all whites were in danger. Now, the British hated the guts of the Dutch then and now, but the British came to the defense of the Dutch against Dingaan. And Dingaan met them on the Bell River, gave a splendid account of himself, but shields and spears are no match for cannon. Dingaan butchered so many bodies and threw them in the river till the river streaked with blood, and they renamed it the Blood River. But now, with the help of the British, the Dutch defeated him, drove him into exile, 1838, and he died 1840. So now, with the death of Dingaan, the British would bring to power a puppet, Impande. Impande violated all the rules used to govern a Zulu king. He married into family, wasn't designated for the king. The king had to marry to a certain family, certain goods raised from birth to be wives of the king. He didn't marry them. He married other women, and he changed them regularly. The fat beer-drinking slob. He was so ignorant, the British made out his death warrant and put it before him, and he signed it. But in the 1870s, this weakling produced a strong son, and his people overthrew him in favor of the son named Cetshwayo. Cetshwayo reorganized the Zulus into a fighting force and met the British, literally defeating them in one of the decisive battles for the control of South Africa, the Battle of Assiniboine. Made the mistake many Africans made. He went to England after that to see the Queen. While he was in England seeing the Queen, the British broke his country up into 13 different parts, and he couldn't communicate with them after that. He subsequently died. The main point is to point to events in the African world on the eve of the Civil War in the aftermath of these events. The British in Ghana, then called the Gold Coast, decided that they would take the religious ornament of the Ghana, the most sacred of all, the golden stool, brought by a great priest, Akampo Enochi. But the British decided they would take it because they said the spirit of the Ghanaian people rests in the stool. And the priest told them, if you lose the stool, you lose your soul, and the people will die. The British, hearing of this legend, decided the best way to break the spirit of the Shanti people is to take the stool. Now, they had tried first in 1805. A young governor named MacLean decided he would go up and show the British he can take the stool. The king of Saratutukawamine sent word back, if you come up here, I will send your head back to the coast on a silver platter. So the fool kid did come to Kumasi, the headquarters of the Santi people, and Kawamine did cut his head off and sent it to the coast on a silver platter. He expected war. This was the beginning of the Asante War. It lasted through the exile of Kempe, where the British burned down Kumasi twice, still could not defeat them. But the last in the series of wars did not end until 1901, led by a woman, yea, a fancy one. She held the British at bay for 9 months, asking no quarter, giving no quarter. She laid the basis for modern Ghana. Because once she was exiled, having been defeated by the famous Caribbean regiment, called the West Indian Regiment, she wasn't defeated, but when she saw them, she thought her brothers were coming from the West to help her. So she told her soldiers, oh, our brothers from the West coming to help us at last, none too soon. She didn't know that they were in the pay of the British. They were soldiers of the British. So one plane opened fire under a white lieutenant, and another plane refused to fire, so we didn't come here to fight our own people. Mm. But after this, she gave up. The British exiled her to Seychelles Island in the Red Sea to join her cousin, Prempeh. But a young Ghanaian politician, Case the Hayford, started a campaign for the return of the exiled king and queen. And out of this campaign, he converted it into a campaign for independence. In 1931, when he died, he called for his successor. This is a custom in Africa, to train your successor. He called for J.C., Joseph D. Donkwa. Joseph D. Donkwa is the man that trained Nkrumah originally, and the one who sent Nkrumah money to London to come home when he found that the student was graduating from college, but he was broke in London. He's the one that sent Nkrumah money to come home. Joseph B. Dunqua had built the political party out of which Nkrumah would take CPP. That's a bigger story. There's other time to tell it. Nkrumah really took the young people out of the convention, out of the Gold Coast Convention, United Gold Coast Convention, and formed the Convention People's Party. That angered his schoolmaster. All right. Now, in North Africa, another drama unfolding, the result of the Ottoman occupation of Egypt, had left Egypt saddled with a royal family of Armenian and Turkish descent. And among the outstanding leaders, outstanding or famous but not righteous, a man named Muhammad Ali. That was his name. Same as the fighter. When I brought this up to Muhammad Ali, I said, "Do you know you've taken the name of an Arab of a slave trade?" Said, well, Elijah Muhammad gave me the name. Elijah Muhammad needs to read some history. Muhammad Ali was a slave trader. And the man tried to destroy all of the old objects of Egypt. Don't give me no old bones and stone. Give me something new. Had no respect for the ancient history of Egypt. Egypt then had invaded the Sudan, where the Muslims of the Sudan, of another Muslim group, told the Egyptians, your dogs and running dogs of imperialism, and that you're poor Muslim, Allah will strike you dead. You know, violated our faith, because no one Muslim is supposed to turn on another Muslim. You've done sacrilegious thing of coming down here trying to conquer the Sudan. Ultimately, the Egyptians got stuck in the Sudan and the British had to rescue them. And subsequently, the British ended up ruling the Sudan. So all over the world, we are fighting. Wrongly or rightly, but we are fighting. In the West Indies, in this country, in Africa, nobody is sleeping during this period. Nobody slept during this century. This was a century of greater black alertness than we have right now. And yet, this is the time when a great Caribbean scholar left St. Thomas and St. Croix, went out to Africa to find his African relatives. Not only found them, but found the condition under which they were enslaved. His name is Edmund Biltmont Blyden. Blyden went back to Liberia, where he became president of Liberia College. And in his famous inaugural address, 1881, he called attention to some of the tragedies we have not finished or addressed ourselves to today. We strive to be those things most unlike ourselves. We feed grist into other people's mills. Don't take care of those things that belong to us. Because this is our, because nothing comes out except what has been put in. Then this, he said, is our great sorrow. So now, at the middle of the 19th century, we're facing an ideological conflict. The independent church is getting underway because we want to distinguish ourselves from African people. We stop calling ourselves African people, and though when we found the independent church, we called the independent church African. African Methodist Episcopal, African Methodist Zion, African Cutter, African, but African. And our comedians were called the African Rascals and the Ethiopian Clown. We were not afraid of the word African. Now we began to use the word color, which could mean anything or nothing. Later on, the word Negro, which is not a word for people at all. Some lazy Spaniard or Portuguese took a descriptive adjective and made a noun out of it, slapped it on a people. When you answer to what you are not, you become what you are not. Richard B. Moore, in his little book, the name Negro, its origin and evil use, that slaves and dogs are named by their masters. We men name themselves. So the proper name for a people must always relate to land, history, and culture. And anytime anyone calls you by a name that hasn't got Africa in it any place, they have called you out of your name. And you are offended, or should be. Now, we are solving some of these problems and we are creating new problems. But we are looking on for white people have an argument. We've done this before. And we're still doing it. Like our astronaut. we still hear conversations among whites, and we assume that they're talking about us. They're even thinking about us. The Constitution said we were three-fifths of man. And nobody ever said that we are not. What and why must we pay taxes if we're not even full human beings? We can make a good case for not paying taxes. But if you test it, one day some wild man who don't care much for God or the devil is going to put it to a test. You don't care what comes after, as long as it's tested. I make a good case for blacks not having to pay taxes. Thought you collected it already. All those 300 years you didn't give me no salary. You got your money. All right. Now, on the eve of the Civil War, slavery is an emotional issue. The Douglas-Lincoln debate, the talk with Frederick Douglass himself, still alive. Slavery is an issue and a debate. But the real issue leading to the Civil War was not slavery. These northern city stickers and the southerner didn't come in with nothing, not even a decent rag on his body. I have said before, Europe dumped its human garbage can into the so-called New World. The worst of that garbage can was dumped into the United States. Now, in the South, debtors, prisoners, women from wash houses, nobody. Marrying Anglo-Saxon women, whatever they would, so they can call themselves Anglo-Saxon, looking for a social state someplace. Slavery and cotton took them out of their degradation so fast that they were dressed up and didn't even know how to use a fork. Didn't know what to do at a bank. Now, these southerners that had grown rich on our back now had a conflict. The northerners wanted the southerners to become furnishers of raw material for the north. If the southerners asked, and rightly so, inasmuch as the cotton is here in the South, why not put the textile mills down here? The New Englanders say, oh, no, we got mills up here. You send the cotton up there, we'll, Jim. We'll take care of the finishing. You just take care of the producing. Some of the great forests then in the South, a lot of the wood building materials coming from the South. The South was a furnisher of things. The embryo of American industry was just getting underway. Most of the coal was coming from the South. And the South wanted a share of the wealth of the country. And when the northern liberal type underwrote the work of the Quakers trying to take the slaves away from the southerners, the southerners said that you are northern hypocrites. You sold me the slave, made money from it, and you used part of that money to try to take the slave away from me. I said, no, I won't know. It was not that the South was more principled than the North. It was not that any, neither one of them had any principle. Have none now. It's just up south, up down south. The country is basically the same. But the money people who sell in the United States, escaping persecution, so-called, their words, generally sell in the New England states. The poor whites of Europe generally sell in the South. Now they got a footing out of slavery and the exploitation of a lot of white slaves too, especially Irish and Slavs and some Germans. Slavery had gotten them out of the barrel, and now they've found the void. So this argument continues until some hot-headed Southerners fires at Fort Sumter. Now look at the South. This look at the whole situation, because really this is a family fight between whites and whites. It's not much of a civil war, because now the Southern candidate cadets at West Point had the choice of choosing to fight for the South or to fight for the North. Most of the Southern cadets had to return home and fight for the North, fight for the South. Now, the South fought like hell, and the South gave a splendid account of themselves because they had no place to go back up against the war, fighting an industrial part of the United States that could outproduce it. Now, people began to make opportunities out of this war. Several families began to sell to the North and the South and laid the basis of their fortune selling to both. And among those who made fortune was the former governor of New York City, Herbert Lehman. Herbert Lehman's family.
The rest of
a lot of families, a lot of people sold to both sides.
Okay.
Don't get hungry again?
No, I'm straight.
Straight, huh? I'm going to bring you two pairs down here just in case you get hungry.
Okay. Okay. So you need to make a move, okay.
Yeah, where you were
then? Right here, though.
The other war.
Right there. Get it all together so I can grab it.
Now, the South did not want blacks to. The North didn't want them either. But things got so difficult, the South began to have black quartermasters be laboring through. Wagon masters, quartermasters to deliver food, keep the supplies. A few were fighting men, but only a few in the South. But in New England, they raised several regiments, including the famous black regiment from Connecticut and the like, to distinguish itself. Distinguished itself so well that in one battle, that regiment won 16 Congressional Medals of Honor. It has never been done before or since, because America decided that black, even if he was brave, he would not be awarded that way ever again, to the extent that an order went out that no black would get the Congressional Medal of Honor during the Second World War. Nobody got it. It had nothing to do with bravery. If you were to get the Congressional Medal of Honor, then your commander must write you up and recommend you for it. And no white commander was there, inasmuch as a secret order had been circulated in the army against the idea of giving blacks Congressional Medals of Honor. And this is why. There's a little known stipulation in the Congressional Medal Award that any Congressional Medal of Honor winner can on demand to address the combined houses of the Senate and the House of Representatives. No one ever did it, but they feared that if it was ever going to be done, maybe a black would get up there and speak his piece. And there's nothing in law they could have done to stop it, because that is part of the stipulation. And then in the war in Korea, most of the blacks who got it posthumously, after they died. The war in Vietnam, three who got it, most of them were crazy. One was in the medic. He went to see Eisenhower. I saw him on the news wheel. He said that I didn't win this medal for my country. I didn't win this medal for my company. I didn't win this medal, you know, for my country, myself. Won this medal for my country. That fool ain't gonna be no harm to nobody. Another one went back to Detroit, having won the medal, and blacks razzed him so. What you over there killing those little brown people for and getting a medal? You think you big stuff. No Vietnamese ever call you nigger. What you killing them for? That's the clue he was brave. He started holding up grocery stores. So finally, one man beat him on the draw and went on to meet his maker. So those that did get it didn't turn out to be much. All right, now back to the Civil War. Because a whole lot of blacks fought in the Civil War, fought exceptionally well in the Civil War, won medals, saved companies. And Abraham Lincoln himself said, and this is in one of Lincoln's diaries, except for the blacks on the Potomac, guarding the Potomac, the Southerners would have taken Washington. Blacks guarded that capital and guarded it well. Guarded it so well until one night Abraham Lincoln was coming home and for some reason didn't have a stovepipe hat. So he challenged President at the gates of the White House. Who goes there? President. President of what? The president of the country. You don't look like no president to me. Where's your hat? Turned it back. Finally, the captain of the guard came and identified Lincoln and let him in the White House. The next morning, Lincoln, thinking that this soldier might be punished for such a treatment, Lincoln had literally recommended he be promoted for doing his job so well. Lincoln said, if you stop me from point in the White House. I know no spy can get it in. Lincoln ought to be promoted that next day. But blacks gave a splendid account of themselves, not only in the war, but there was another side of the war. Blacks served as spies and agents. Among those was Sojourner Truth, from, you know, Harriet Tubman, who had gone into the South and freed any number of slaves and never let a slave turn back. You things get rough, they want to turn back and go back to the plantation. He said, I'll kill you right here first. You're nobody going back. I'll kill you and bury you right here. She followed the stars in the skies until she got them out of the South. And so when the war was over, Lincoln was reluctant to sign the Emancipation Proclamation. Wrote several drafts. Finally, it was signed. Feed the slaves in states where he had no control, but he didn't free them in states where he did have control. He freed them as a tactic to weaken the South and hasten the end of the war. He had said if he could save the Union and free the slaves, he would do it, and if he could save the Union and hold the slaves, he would do it. We were not an issue. Our freedom was not an issue. Now, he issued his Emancipation Proclamation, wasn't even popular with his cabinet, wasn't popular with the country. Where would these slaves go? In parts of Texas, they did not even get the news to the slaves, and they did not become emancipated until June the 10th. This is why you've got the only black holiday in the United States that is celebrated is Juneteenth in Texas. If you want to get drunk and curse out a white man in Texas, do it on Juneteenth. He lets you get away with it on that day. That's your Emancipation Day. Rest of the week, you straighten up. But now, we were facing new problems and some old ones. Some of us could vote now. After Lincoln was shot, there was some wonder about what would have happened to us had Lincoln lived. Lincoln had a plan of getting us out of here, and he said that he did not believe any of us could behave in social company equal to whites. So if you want to know what would have happened had Lincoln not been shot, and I'm sorry he was shot. But he would have at least tried to get us out of here because he didn't think we were suitable to the new climate in the United States. I'm not talking about the physical climate. I'm talking about the political climate. And after the Civil War, when he addressed some Southerners to show how he was still a Southerner at heart, the first thing he said was, let the band play Dixie. Now, who made Lincoln a great hero? You did. You were the ones who hailed Lincoln. Whites caricatured him and spoke of him lower than they speak of dogs. You hailed him as a great emancipator, and you joined the Republican Party, the party of Lincoln, and, you know, and followed Mr. Lincoln's party. You not going to deviate. And one of our great orators, Roscoe Simmons Conklin, all of you must be too young to remember the great Roscoe Simmons Conklin, world's greatest orator. I thought he was the greatest showman. He always ended his speech and said that I have but one party. It is the Republican Party. I have but one race. It is the human race. Having hailed Lincoln, he would sit down amid great applause, Rocktail Colt and all. Great Roscoe Simmons Conklin. But we hailing Lincoln as the great emancipator gave Lincoln a presence as a hero in America he otherwise would not have. And the first person to write a favorable book about Lincoln was an Englishman. John Drinkwater wrote a favorable book about Lincoln, now the ambulance of books about Lincoln as a folk hero began to flood the country. But after he was shot, unfortunately, a President Johnson, who was almost impeached, except for one vote, he would have been impeached, he was so inept, couldn't understand anything, misunderstood Lincoln's instructions, and he would have done us in, but he didn't have enough intelligence to even know how. So he continued some of the programs already on the book, not knowing that they didn't believe in those programs in the first place. Now the Freedmen's Bureau was set up, a bureau for the freedmen, Freedmen's Bank. For 11 years, we enjoyed pseudo-democracy. We had congressmen, 23 in all, mayors, probably more mayors for one time than we got right now. Not that any of them of any value to us. Symbolically, yes. Mayor of Gabesta, Texas. Mayors in the Deep South. Blacks were head of treasury, treasurers of state. In North Carolina, they had a majority in the House for a brief period. We made the mistake that we nearly always make when things are partially good. We don't plan for the time when they won't be good anymore. Now the blacks united with the poor whites in the South, and they introduced some of the best legislation ever introduced in this country, because the blacks had no money for private schools and neither did the poor whites. They introduced the basis of the American public school. And we know, what did these black legislators do? The Southerners maligned them, so they came into the legislature eating peanuts and, you know, with a glass of corn liquor in their pocket, which has never been proven to be true. The whole birth of the nation bit. But these were some able men. George Eliot, Brown Eliot was an able man. I mean, there were some great, not only some great legislators, some great orators, and some great thinkers came out of it. Out of this same atmosphere came Pinchback, who was Lieutenant Governor of Louisiana and briefly Governor of Louisiana. These some able men. Out of the same group came two senators, both from Mississippi. Best known, Blanche Calico Bruce. Bruce, after he was no longer senator, then he was Register of the Treasury and going home on a Jimco train, but they hadn't broken. Jimco started Washington, so he was in Washington, and they hadn't broken the cars down, so black would be in one section, white would be in the second. So he was sitting there, and incidentally, his old slave master was talking to another old slave master. I wonder what happened to that young slave I had named Bruce. Smart as a whippersnapper. What the hell, didn't know what happened to him. Had a little education, too. Don't know how he got it. Bruce sitting behind him. Bruce took out a dollar and showed him. That's what happened to him. He's now Secretary of Treasury. Ended the mystery, ended the conversation. But we were so busy celebrating this pseudo-integration, this experiment in racial democracy that a whole lot of people didn't mean. And this could come about because the Southerners who were in political power doing the Civil War, who brought on the Civil War, were now barred from political office. Barred from political office. This gave some poor white and black an opportunity they never had before. And together, they began to make the legislation that would change the South. Then certain black and white organizations began to emerge on the eve of the time when the old guard Southerners would be permitted to return to public office. Colored and white farmers among them. That's what frightened them. Just like Martin Luther King's Poor People's March on Washington, taking both white and black poor, fighting the nation, and they ended up killing him. Now blacks were advocating a union between poor blacks and poor whites, and the poor whites were going for it. What could they lose? They were poor. Their status wasn't much better than the slave. Now a political thing would happen. During the election campaign of Rutherford B. Hayes and Tilden, horse trading would take place, and in exchange for the Democratic vote, the radical Republicans turned conservative and said that if you vote, throw the election for Hayes, we will pull the troops out of the South and let you handle the Negroes as you see fit. They elected Hayes, and the horse traders kept their promise. They pulled the troops out of the South. They gradually began to dismantle the Freedmen's Bureau and the Freedmen's Bank. The promise about 40 acres and a mule was withdrawn. We were on the edge of some dark days in this country without any friends, any place. In the midst of this, we had to build institutions. We had to get a college education. We had to literally borrow teachers from New England, the New England school mom period. This is the period when a group of white women in New England, the first educated white women in the New England state, white men in New England, mostly non-college graduates, didn't know what to do with a college-bred woman, didn't know what to say to her. Can't chase her to the kitchen. Because all he thought good, the woman was good for the kitchen, the church, and bad children. Now, these educated white women began to retreat, move to the South in large number to teach in the new schools established for blacks. Sometimes the Ku Klux Klan burned down the schools. Some of them persisted. Some of them gave up, married Southerners, and became Southerners. But this was a period that tested us as we've never been tested before. This is the period when we had a dynamic ministry, a more dynamic church. This is when we gave up old troubles, took on new troubles. And I'm saying the caliber of black men and women that came out of that last part of that century called the nadir, or our darkest hour, speaks well for us as a people, speaks well for any people. And if we in the 20th century knew what they were up against and how they fought and won some battles, losing some, odds we never faced, odds we could not even believe. But these were the battles men and women of caliber, not only in this country, but in the Caribbean islands and in Africa. No TV to expose them, nothing, no help, no press releases. Against all kinds of odds, they gave this people a strong shoulder and the ability to move down to the end of the 19th century and the ability to enter the 20th century. These were our men and women of valor. And in the period after the Civil War, this was our finest generation. Thank you.
Anything 100 times faster when you hear this strange frequency. Have you ever heard of the Freemasons? They've secretly wielded a
Cipriani.
Yeah.
All of these being African. And that brings to mind the fact that the original church or Christianity as we have come to know it was first established among African people.
It was established and brought into being by, the Christian church as we know it today. The Christian church. Let's make a distinction between the formal Christian church and the ideas of Christianity. That's a world of difference between that. Now, this is well documented in the book called Roman Africa. Roman taxation and Roman imperial brutality made people question old religions, look to new religions, and they turned to myth and supposition, and brought into being out of myth the story of a resurrected Christ.
What made them choose Jesus? And that also brings
They didn't at first, because he was never referred to as Jesus in his lifetime. Most of the writing about him occurred 80 years after his death, and
as he began to run, is Jesus, the Christ. The very word Christ is not of African origin. It's from Krishna. It's more of Indian, East Indian origin than African.
Rogers tells us that the word means the black one, the anointed one, because
it could well
the kiss of the sun was worthy of being the most anointed.
It could well mean that.
Now, this Jesus, who we know from the study of history, was a black man.
Whose picture we know?
Oh, yes, sure, I think it's the proper word.
Now, let's make a distinction between the physical Jesus and the picture that the Pope commissioned Michelangelo to write, to paint in the 15th century. At the Conference of Nicaea, where they lost the books of the Bible that they didn't want to deal with, by putting them on the table and said that in the morning, the books that God don't want us to use will be gone. So there wasn't lost books of the Bible. They were the books that was left out of the Bible, especially the Book of Mary. It tells you what Joseph said when he discovered Mary was with child. He knew it wasn't his child. Otherwise, they could not create the Immaculate Conception had they left the Book of Mary in there. The idea of Immaculate Conception old, because in Africa, a woman can have 9 children if her reputation is good and honorable, and if she's frequented only by one man, the African will say that her skirt is clean, her mouth is sweet. She is virgin. So the idea of virginity has absolutely nothing to do with whether you have had a child by process of cohabitation or not. Because the Europeans now want to create something that has a similar purity. They now would give a lady a child without having intercourse with a man.
Well, this also has something to do with the fact that most of them were misogynists. They didn't want to... But they couldn't get around exalting a woman to a higher state in the Christian church because most people at the time that they were trying to convert to the religion was into the Mother Goddess concept. And in order to elevate Mary to that status, they had to take her out of the realm of humanity, so to speak.
They had to make a supernatural Mary. And I think it's unfair to her because they had to dehumanize her by elevating her above human. And Mary, not Christ, should be at the heart, the focal point of the Christian religion.
Well, that ironic as it is, the Catholics in some way have done that.
They have done that in some of their ritual that they have steadily fought against, even having a minor female administrator in the church.
Now, this person who eventually came to be called Jesus,
the picture that we get wasn't painted until the 15th century.
What was the actual life? What was happening in the Hebrew? He was a Hebrew, we know that. And what was happening with the Hebrews? What was the dynamic going on between them and the Roman government at that time who were occupying their land in that little nation of Judea?
The Romans occupying their land until they got on the Romans' nerves and the Romans destroyed the last temple at 70 A.D.
But they say it was a hotbed there, especially where Jesus was raised, around Nazareth and Galilee, was a hotbed of rebellion. They were constantly carrying out some type of revolt.
But they're still doing it. We're talking about people of the Hebrew faith as distinguished between people we call Jews. The word Jew had its greatest development in Europe. There are people of the Hebrew faith all over the world.
in India, China, and South Sea Islands, who never used the word Jew, who still belong to the Hebrew faith, and whose conversion to the Hebrew faith is older than that of Europe. The Europeans, Hebrews, were converted in the 8th century, age 50 or thereabouts.
Well, they felt that the Romans really had no right to rule over them, not only because they were invaders, but their law said, their Torah said, that only God ruled for them. Only the Creator was their ruler.
This
ruled through their king that came out from their midst.
But the Romans were no respecter of local customs or local laws. And even with the trial of Jesus Christ for sorcery, the Romans did not want a part of it. But according to Roman law, the crime of sorcery was major and therefore had to be taken to the Roman government. Minor crimes, they could try themselves. So when they took him before the Roman emperor, the Roman emperor realized that he was no enemy of Rome. He wasn't telling Romans to give their money to the poor or turn the other cheek. He wasn't driving Romans from the temple. He was driving his own people. So the Romans had no vested interest in interfering with all of this internal matter between people they had colonized. And so he pushed them back to the province, and he's your king. And they pushed him back toward the Romans, and not my king. So we see the essential beauty and loneliness of the story, and the man who eventually emerges, Jesus Christ, was one of a number of itinerant ministers roaming through the land at that time, and who had the smallest amount of followers. Why did he survive? The others got lost. His people were then what they are now, great record keepers.
And evangelizers.
And they are also, when necessary, great record changers. And maybe some of the greatest liars under the eye of God.
Now, the first Christians we know were Africans, so the original church was first developed and its strongest hold in Africa.
See, but the African Christian developed before the church developed as a physical body. I agree with what you're saying, but I'm saying that that was not the birth of Christianity, or the African concept of Christianity developed before the church. The church in a physical sense began to develop when the Romans decided they could use it, therefore encouraged it after the Romans stopped killing Christians and began to join the church for political reasons.
They thought it was more economically expedient to join it than to continue the expense of
This was in Constantine made Christian religion of the Eastern Roman Church. Subsequently, the others didn't. Plus the fact that many Roman emperors were entertaining themselves on Saturday by seeing the Christians killed with the lions and gladiators. Finally, one Roman looked down in the arena and saw his uncle, so he didn't stop the show. He said, "Uncle, go well." Then next Saturday, he looked down and there was his wife and the child willing to die in the arena. He said, "Stop the show. Investigate this thing."
Well, Constantine's own mother, Helena, had been converted to Christianity, and that had a great impact on him making that decision.
Well, making that decision also with the little-known people called the Essenes. And the Essenes were, in addition to being moralists, were vegetarians that day. And they approached him by fornicating in the palace and
It's Aspen Dental Summer of Smiles event with epic savings for new and returning patients. Book today.
You agreed to stop that, then they told him he had to stop eating red meat. Then he told them equivalent to go to hell with your religion. So they left him alone. So all right. If you stop on occasion, we'll leave you with your meat, you know. Then he tolerated it enough to make it the religion of Eastern Roman Church, although he never really, with any degree of sincerity, joined the church.
And St. Augustine said in one of his writings that the true religion, which had existed from the foundation of earth, came to be known as Christianity. So he very well knew.
Came to be known as Christianity.
And very well knew, obviously, that this was no new concept. There was no new.
John Jackson is Christianity before Christ. Did a good job on this. Another work called Pagan Origins of the Christ Myth. John Jackson is so terribly underrated because John Jackson is a cynic and God's angry man, but
man of superior intelligence.
Yeah, and a fine memory of almost everything that ever touched his mind. That an angry, disappointed man. But he was my friend for more than 50 years.
I, too, have learned so much from him. I never got to meet him in person, but from his writings. And his writings would prick me so I would sometimes have to go for weeks just wrestling with the point. When I first read Man, God, and Civilization, I had to wrestle with that book, but it opened up a whole new area of enlightenment.
But see, in just his own writing, he introduces you to other writers that you need to investigate. Jackson introduced me to Joe Massey, Alvin Boyd Kuhn, writers of that nature, pro-African Europeans that Europeans still ignore.
Now, when this, when Constantine finally, when he decided that he was going to take this, what he considered to be a new religion, and now use it to revitalize the empire, and also use it as a mechanism to control the mind, he said the only way we can do this is to have an orthodoxy. If you have an orthodoxy, that means the people cannot or are not allowed to think or question beyond a certain level of belief. How did he go about that?
This. Designating certain priests to interpret the Bible. The Bible wasn't widely read or widely circulated. The Catholic Church up until the end of the 19th century, a lot of Catholic laymen didn't even read the Bible. They had it interpreted to them, but they didn't read it. Either you had blind faith and to believe what the priest said, or you weren't a good Catholic.
Well, I understand that in some places the Bible was chained to walls and only certain priests could read it, not even all the priesthood could, and you could get varying degrees of punishment if you were caught reading it, even up to death, depending upon what your station was in life.
Mm-hmm.
And this went on for many, many years throughout Christendom as it was dominated by the Catholic Church.
Most Christians don't know it today. Don't know the different versions it went through. It was changed. The final version is in right now.
Well, some folks say, well, since it's gone through all this, since it's been polluted so much, what do we need with it? What can we do? Why don't we just throw it away and start all over again? Should we do that, or what should we know it?
I think we should try to understand it as part of religious literature and mythology, but I question the intelligence of anyone who thinks the Bible is true or supposed to be true.
St. Augustine said the same thing. He said, anyone who takes the book of Genesis literally is accrediting to God those attributes that are not worthy of him.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And most of the book of Moses was written after Moses was dead.
Now, there were men and women during closer to our times in antebellum slavery or during our captivity that went to the Bible
which had been denied them. They were not permitted to read the Bible on pain of death, actually, by their captors. But when they did get to it, when some quote-unquote well-meaning white person would teach them a text or something, they had a unique interpretation that was relative to their situation. Among them, we think of men like the Right Reverend Nat Turner and Reverend Gabriel Prosser and Denmark Vesey and Harriet, Right Reverend Mother Harriet Tubman, and people like that.
But then Bishop Turner at the end of the day, Bishop Henry McNeil Turner at the end of the century.
And Henry Harlan Garnett.
Who used it as a revolutionary weapon.
So does that say we can take it now and use it as a tool for liberation?
Right now. We can use this song the same way, if we would. But religion's authoritarian. And there's such thing as religious fascism. Some medicines have turned it into that, a way of dominating the mind and controlling the body.
But Dr. Clark, we certainly thank you for this opportunity. This has been a wonderful and enlightening session. And in closing out here, I'd like to for you to just sum up in your own thoughts, feelings, remember to the subject matter we have been discussing here, and share with us that which you think would help us to take us to the next stage of understanding.
A discussion of religions in general, Christianity in particular, gets us into the question of what can we use for our own liberation, the maintenance of liberation once we achieve it. And what is good for us is what brings us to that point of liberation, independence, and maintenance. When I say independence, I don't mean independent to commit crime, independence to violate morality. I mean to be free of exploitation, to be free of being demeaned, and to have the right to project yourself as a part of the totality of history. We have to restore the humane apparatus to religions that has been extracted by exploiters who use religion the wrong way. I think we must use religion to give the world a new humanity. But we have lost the meaning unless we understand that we must first give it to ourselves. Because you cannot change the world until first you change yourself. I think all religion is good depending on its application, and all have the potential of being bad depending on its poor application. I think all of us should have the integrity to make that distinction and apply it for the good of ourselves and for all humankind, are giving each one the right to choose the interpretation that suits that particular case without demeaning that the interpretations that suit other cases for other people. I have long ago left the adherence to any form of organized religion. And I belong to an African belief system. And I am comfortable spiritually with that belief system that furnishes me the integrity and the spirituality and the support that I think I need in my life. Because this is a humane belief system, I'm not ready to deprive others of having an opinion different from me, but I'm also have the nerve to let others know that once any belief system that fails to serve the basic human needs of people and the basic protection of people is open to question, and I'm not above asking that kind of question.
In other words, you
See, they're bringing spirituality back to religion.
Yeah. Bringing spirituality back to religion. And religion will become nonpartisan and not clannish and selfish.
Thank you again, Dr. Clark. Brothers and sisters, we have just had the opportunity and the great privilege of engaging in an interview with Dr. John Henry Clark, Dean of African Senate Scholars and great African thinkers, whom we have the privilege of walking the planet with in this day and time. We pray that his work will continue to be blessed by our ancestors and by the Creator, and we pray that he will be with us for many, many years to come, because he is a great treasure to us all, greatly beloved by all of us. Thank you so much for being with us. This is a part of the ongoing series of the African Origin of the Bible. Thank you again, Dr. Clark.
Okay.
This is one of you. I have been like a little child on his way to a candy store all day because I had never been on camera with you. And I was really looking forward to doing this. I am so glad.
Sorry that I just got the message while I was away in Philadelphia. My tickets for the conference in London arrived so late I thought they'd forgotten about it. Thursday, early in the morning. Okay.
As long as you've known me. Dr. Barashenko, we're trying to look at the political, economic, and cultural conditions of the Hebrew Israelites during the time that Jesus would have been on the scene in Palestine and the Roman occupation. What would it be like? Can you give us an overview of one?
Very complex
an efficient military machine. That's what they had going for them in their favor. In terms of intellect, they had never been known for that. They had to get their intellect from the Greeks, who themselves admitted that they got it from the Africans. But the Romans had that organizing skill. They're something like the Germans of today. They had that organizing skill. So they now come into Palestine. They are overlords in Palestine, and they're ruling over a people who are very difficult to rule over because if you are a foreign ruler, if you're a foreign potentate, because they believed, according to their laws, the laws of Moses, the Torah, that no one was to rule them but Almighty God, and that Almighty God would rule them either through their king or their judges or their prophets or their priests. But whoever the ruler was in the land, they had to be connected with them as a people, born out and bred by them as a people, and practice, at least claim to practice, their religion and their culture. And they said as long as they were not ruled by someone like that of their own, then they were in disfavor with God. And therefore, to get back in favor with God, they had to have sovereign independence. Those two things were one and the same in their thinking. So they kept a holy war going on consistently, a stubborn holy war against the Romans. Now, they did not have the arms and the might and the organizational structure that the Roman military complex had, but they did have the tenacity. And they fought what we know as guerrilla warfare, which is very effective when you have a smaller force or ill-equipped force fighting against a more advanced or sophisticated force. You use guerrilla warfare. And they...
What was the Roman army like, chariots and so forth? Can you kind of explain if they had something called pillow marches or whatever?
The flanks. The flanks. The Roman flanks was very difficult to break. It was, they would send out, I believe it was a cohort. It may have been more, about a cohort of soldiers. And they would come in this flanks. And they would march with these shields, these rectangular shields with like a spear point on them. They would march with these shields. When they got in place, when you would shoot arrows at them or throw spears at them, they would turn those things in precision and form a flanks around them. They would form a protective coat around them from the sides, from the front, from the back, and the top. The ones in the middle put theirs on the top, and the ones on the side turn theirs to the side, to their flanks, and the ones in the front turn their flanks. And that was very difficult to break them that way. Their cavalry was very good. They had expert cavalry. And, of course, their charioteers were outstanding. Most of their charioteers were from Persia or from out of Africa or some land of where black people lived. That's where many of their charioteers came from. And their most outstanding legion, the greatest of all the legions they possessed in their army, was the 10th Legion, and that was the African Legion, the Leopard Men.
Well, Rome had a multicultural army.
Well, yeah, like most governments will get anybody to fight for them. They had Germans, they had a German contingency fighting for them, they had a Gaul contingency fighting for them. Any place where they had gone and had taken conquest of the people, they conscripted those people to go to war for them, just like any imperial state does, just like America does, that all imperial countries do that. And Rome definitely was an imperial country. So they ruled stringently, very stringently. And when they came into Palestine, which is actually a part of Africa, they didn't come with any women. Very few of them had women. A few of the officers of the governor may have brought his wife with him, but they didn't have any women. So they took the women by force who were there. So there was a struggle over that, because the men didn't want them coming and taking their women. You had a group that went to the mountains and fought from the mountains. This group was known as the Zealots. They were the freedom fighters of that nation. They were beloved of that subjugated nation, and they were supported by the people of that subjugated nation. Their headquarters and their hotbed was in the hills of countries of Galilee. And Nazareth was one of their main places where they came to get their supplies, where Jesus was raised up. That's where they came to get their supplies. So they constantly waged war against the Romans. Now, At times it was more intense than others, because when Tiberius Caesar, who was the Caesar or the president of Pax Romana, as you would call it, of the Roman Empire at that time, sent Governor Pontius Pilate to be governor over that region, which incorporated Judea, Syria, and I think a couple of other places and provinces. Judea was a small nation within it, but Judea thought of itself as separate and apart from all the rest of it. When he was sent there, one of the first things he did was take money from the temple treasury, which was forbidden. And even the Uncle Tom preachers, who were these Pharisees that you heard Jesus riding against so much, you scribes and Pharisees, because of their betrayal of the people. They were the Negro preachers of that day. And when they took the money from the temple, even the Pharisees now, who were generally kept the people in check, kept it from being an overall outright people's revolution and uprising. They now even began to join the zealot movement and to fight against the Romans. And the thing which was the camel, the proverbial straw that broke the camel's back, was when Pilate came in and had an eagle, a Roman eagle, placed over the temple, which was the center of worship for the Israelites in Jerusalem. And that's when everybody became involved in rebellion against them, because that was a desecration, a sacrilege, that was idolatrous as far as they were concerned. And they would die rather than offend their God. So everybody went to war. And that rebellion was led by one Judas of Galilee. Yeshua ben Judas of Galilee was his name. And he led thousands upon thousands against them. He was taken, it was in the year 6 CE. The one whom you call Jesus may have been about 12 years old then. And he had to, on a particular day, a very sad day in the nation of Judea, he had to walk home through a row of crosses that these black men were hung on, because as we have talked about before in previous sessions, the Israelites were black people before, and they were black people then. You had some admixture there, but not to the degree that it later became. So on those crosses hung approximately 2,000 men who had been in rebellion against Rome. That's how they punished those who rebelled against them. And at the head of that was Yeshua ben Judas of Galilee. And this obviously made quite an impression on the young mind of the Yeshua ben Joseph, or Jesus as you call him, the Christ as you call him, that we know of in the New Testament. So what the Romans said was this. Tiberius said, look, Pilate, we can't afford this, because these people are hard to rule in the first place. And it's taking a lot of expense to rule them, and it's actually not cost efficient if we have to keep fighting them on this level. And we can't keep fighting them and fighting all over the empire to maintain the empire. You cannot go in there and do anything that is opposed to their religious sensibilities. Leave them and their religion alone.
So how did they have the people, what did the Romans make the people do? What was life like under Roman domination?
Under Roman, let me just finish this point here, where Tiberius says to Pilate, don't you ever do that again, because if you do that again, I'm going to recall you from this post. And I may even send you into banishment, because you're costing the Roman government money. So there was agreement made with the preachers, the priests, the Pharisees, that we won't do this desecration anymore if you keep these people in check and quiet them down from carrying this rebellion out any further. So that again, was a source of a problem when Jesus and John the Baptist rose up. This was a thorn in the side of the Negro preachers who wanted to keep everything cooled out, wanted to keep the people from going to war. As a matter of fact, you remember when they took Jesus too, the Romans, and when they had him on trial before them, before they took him to the Romans, they say it's better that this one man should die than the whole nation. They were afraid of those Romans. They didn't have a case against him, but they said, look, we can't have him run out here stirring these people up like this. We made a deal with these Romans. We have power through on this deal. That was the political situation. Now, the Romans could conscript your house. They could grab you and make you carry their burdens for a mile. And later in the book of Mark, he comes up with this lie that Jesus said, if they tell you to carry the burden a mile, offer to carry another mile. If Jesus had told those people something like that, they would have left him. Nobody would have come out to listen to him at all, because he would have gone completely against the sentiment of the people. And there was no way that he could be popular among the people and not speak to their desire for freedom and liberation from those Romans. They could come and take anything virtually from these people they wanted to. They could go in these people's houses and get their wives or daughters or anything. A lot of that went on. And many Hebrew Israelites died trying to defend the honor of his woman or his daughter or his home before these Romans.
So they made the people work and they took the crops. Explain that.
It was a form of enslavement. It was a form of bondage. They subjugated the people. And when a person comes in as a captor and puts you in captivity and subjugates you, then they treat you all kind of ways. They don't treat you as a human being. And they were not treated as human beings. And they were very unhappy people. And that's why every child, that male child that came first in the family, they most of them was named Yeshua, which in English is Jesus. And in Matthew it says, and thou shalt call his name Jesus, for he shall save his people from their sins. Now, people think you're talking about fornication or smoking or drinking or adultery or stealing or something. It wasn't referring to that. Sin to them was an imbalance. The word meant imbalance. And as long as the Romans were ruling over them and not a king who was there as to stand in the place.
Turning the imagined to reality for over 100 years. All right. Imagine that.
We can.
So their God ruling over them to rule as a representative of their God, as a son of God. That's what they call their kings. So it wasn't unusual for Jesus to be called that, and it wasn't the first time. As long as that wasn't happening, they were living in sin. Because they said, we have to be living in sin because we're in God's disfavor. And if we're in God's disfavor, that means we're doing something wrong. And the thing that proves that we're in God's favor is that a foreigner is ruling over us and making us do all sorts of things that we would not be doing, things that are contrary to the laws of Moses and according to our culture and to our morals. So that's the kind of situation you had there with those Romans and the Hebrews. And it was a very unhappy situation. It was not a friendly situation except in those few cases where I said you had the Pharisees and maybe some other people who were